Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org. So good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Lovely to see you all. I can sort of see everybody from behind. I can't see everybody from the front, but thank you so much for the invitation to join you this evening, and hello to friends online as well. I can see some folks online. Lovely to see you all and to see your faces. Oh, there you go. Now I can see Canando from the front as well. My name is Vanessa Abel. I am a remote member of Canando. I lived in the Bay Area from 2016 to 2022. And I was coming to Canando and practicing at Canando at that time. And then since then, I've been coming in to visit and mostly joining remotely like this on Wednesday evenings. I live in France as well. That's where I am. So it's quite early in the morning here. It's sort of a monastic hour, you might call it. It's 5 o'clock already, actually. It's not that early, not by Californian standards. So, there's a collection of koans called the Gateless Gate. Maybe some of you are familiar with it. And the 46th koan in the Gateless Gate, there's a master called Sekizo. And the master puts forward this question. He says, from the top of a pole 100 feet high, how do you step forward? From the top of a pole 100 feet high, how do you step forward? So I find this a very evocative image of a person sort of clinging to the top of this very high pole. And what do you do? You know, what is the predicament of this person up this 100-foot pole? There's another image that's often used in Rinzai teaching. That's the image of being between a mountain and an iron wall. Being between a mountain and an iron wall. And so where do you go? You know, when you're faced with this iron wall and it kind of goes in every direction. How do you negotiate this situation? So the word impossible springs to my mind. You know, maybe this is about impossibility in some way. Just as I'm listening to the Zoom, I can hear that there's some background noise. I think maybe Diane, if you can hear us, your mic is on. So we can hear a little background noise from your mic. I wonder if it's possible to, there we go, lovely. Thank you. So impossibility. You know, perhaps, I'm sure everybody here has had the experience of chanting the Bodhisattva vows. You know, when we chant, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them, etc. where we're turning into an impossibility and saying that we know it's not possible to save all beings. We know it's not possible to end all delusions. And we practice nonetheless. You know, we come here nonetheless. We come to the Zendo. We come to practice. And so this image that's offered, you know, through the sort of the impossibility of the iron wall, the impossibility of the 100-foot pole, you know, if we can really put a little imagination and energy into putting ourselves in that situation and entering that state of mind and that state of being. In the Zen tradition, we actually put a lot of value into putting ourselves there, you know, into sort of putting ourselves into a state of mind where it suddenly seems impossible to go forward. In a way, it's how we develop what we call beginner's mind. You know, this sort of freshness, this idea that actually, well, we don't know what's going to happen next. And so there's a sort of openness to what's coming forward. So this is something that I've been thinking about quite a lot, and especially at the end of last year, I was much closer to you than I was in San Francisco for 3 months for a practice period at the Zen Center. And during that time, I was invited to train and to serve in the role of Shuso. And for those of you not familiar with this terminology, the Shuso is a name for the head student. And during any given practice period, there would be one student in this role of Shuso. And essentially what happens is that the Shuso, we say, shares the seat of the teacher. They share the seat of the teacher, and it's sort of the whole process is a training and a first step towards training as a teacher in the tradition eventually. So taking on the responsibility of supporting the guiding teacher in facilitating this practice period and then beginning to learn how to come forward and support the teaching and support the practice in the temple. So I wanted to share a little bit about this experience with you this evening and how this theme of impossibility related to it. So for me, it was a huge experience, and there were many different narratives of it, you know, many different angles of the experience. But now in retrospect, when I'm looking back on it and many of those details are beginning to fade, I'm noticing that what remains for me is the teaching that I received about breaking through the wall of self-doubt and past the limits, past the points where I know, left to my own devices, I would ordinarily stop. Like, there are certain limits that I put in place for myself, and randomly or not, you know, from my own conditioning or not, from, you know, perhaps the power of my own self-doubt. But there were ways in which, during this practice period, I needed to step through those limits and what that experience was like. And reflecting on this, I really see it as such a beautiful part of Zen practice and such a powerful potential of this practice as well. I'm sure that each one of you in your lives have had some experience of the ways in which this practice has helped to loosen up the boundaries of your thinking and of your being in the world, and some of the narratives that you have about the way in which you see the world. You know, even if it's your first time in the Zendo this evening, you know, perhaps something has shifted. And perhaps you did something that you didn't think you'd be able to do. And this process of beginning to like dissolve boundaries and seeing the boundaries sort of dissipate, you know, seeing the limits kind of melt. It's part of the process of what we call the process of liberation. The things that we think are stopping us begin to fade, and you realize that you're free. You know, you're free to roam around. That gate that you thought was there isn't really there. And then sometimes it's hard to see this. It's hard to see it. So this time at the San Francisco Zen Center in the fall of last year, when I was training as Shuso, I can say with my whole heart was one of the happiest 3 months of my life. It really was. You know, one reason was I got to be immersed in Zen, which is, you know, something that I've loved doing for more than 20 years. And then I got to sort of do it from the moment I got up in the morning until I went to bed at night. But also my family got to come with me. And this was a huge advantage too. I didn't have to choose between going to the monastery and being with my family. And I'm someone who sort of likes to have it all. I like to have my cake and eat it. So for me, you know, this was a lovely thing to happen, but also very important. This situation of being integrated with all of the things that I love, you know, all of the priorities, the roles, the identities, you know, I didn't have to stop being a mother in order to be a priest and vice versa, you know, so being able to hold both of those things at the same time and being invited to do that and having that facilitated at the temple was so important for me. And I think it was significant for the community there as well. So for those of you who haven't been to a practice period, and I have to say I hadn't really experienced this also prior to doing it. The practice period, that somewhere near the beginning of the practice period, there's a ceremony for the Shuso to sort of enter and become Shuso. And if you've never witnessed it, I highly recommend it at some point. It's really like, it's a little drama and it's scripted and you sort of need to learn your lines. And you walk through these motions of the guiding teacher inviting this student to step into the role. And as we say in, you know, good old-fashioned Zen tradition, you have to lead with a no. So that the Shuso, you know, the student sort of says, the student gets invited, and then the student says, no, I couldn't possibly do this. And then they get asked again, and then they refuse, you know, they say, I'm not ready, I'm not worthy, you know, there's clearly been some kind of mistake. no. And this was real. I mean, I was saying these lines, but I was feeling it 100% in my body as well. And then the teacher gives this last response, which is not scripted. he sort of he comes forward with a more personal response, and what I heard was something like, well, you don't feel ready, but here's the thing, none of us are fully formed. Nobody here is fully formed. None of us are perfect. You know, what does it mean to be ready? What does it mean to be ready? So please, please come and join us. And then the Shuso relents and gives in and says, okay, let's do this. And so it's a journey that starts with this assumption in place that we don't start from a place of readiness. Because really, there's no such place. You know, how can we ever be 100% ready for what's coming? And then also that the role, my role, I think all of our roles, is fundamentally to be of service to the Sangha and to the teacher in this case. And so there's lots of day-to-day sort of mundane aspects to the role of the Shuso. One of the things the Shuso has to do is wake everybody up in the morning. So I had to get up a little bit earlier and go to the Zendo and pick up the bell and then run around the city center ringing the bell every day. The Shuso cleans the toilets every day. That's the Shuso's job. So it's a wonderful ways of keeping the student grounded. The Shuso learns how to be doshi. There's lots of training around ceremony, doing morning ceremony, making tea, holding little tea meetings for members of the Sangha, being invited to and learning how to give Dharma talks, and then doing, you know, participating in the regular work of the temple, which in my case was working in the kitchen with my daughter, who was 10 years old at the time. She's 11 now. And this was really wonderful, you know, having the chance to practice together with my daughter, who blew me out of the water how enthusiastic and ready to participate she was. And for those of you who know her, I'm sure you don't have too much trouble imagining that. So all of this experience kind of leads up to a ceremony at the end of the practice period that's specifically a kind of a graduation ceremony for the Shuso. And the ceremony is called a Hosen Shiki. That's the Japanese term for it, a Hosen Shiki. And my understanding is that it translates as Dharma combat. Though I have to say that I was certainly not encouraged to think about it in combative terms, okay? I think there's a way in traditionally it's thought of as Dharma combat. So what it is, it's a very powerful ceremony. And it has a very kind of special energy because it happens at the end of a practice period, but it also happens that it's at the end of a sesshin as well, because there's a sesshin, so like a 7-day silent retreat that ends the practice period. And so it's only really attended by the people who have attended the sesshin and practiced in the sesshin. And then also some people from the community who have also been through the ceremony or who are teachers, so sort of like elders in the tradition. So it's not a public event, you know, it's not something that anyone can just drop into. And so for that reason, there's almost this kind of secretive element about it. I'd only ever seen one in my life. And this was years and years ago, so I couldn't really remember what it was about. And there's, and it's long. Gosh, I think it was at least maybe about an hour and a half long as a ceremony, and lots of parts of it are scripted. And there's lots of very sort of symbolic carrying of objects and reading of passages and moving around the Buddha hall. But the heart of it, and why it's referred to as Dharma combat, is that everybody in the room, and in this case, it was probably about 60 or so people, everybody in the room comes forward to ask the Shuso a question and a Dharma question. So they're not sort of questions like, you know, what's the capital of China? Or like, what's the secret to a good lasagna kind of questions? You know, these are supposed to be, in some ways, the unanswerable questions, you know, the kind of questions that we have around practice, you know, the sorts of questions like, how do you step off a 100-foot pole? The kinds of questions that there isn't really necessarily an answer to. So a large thought in my mind as I was moving through the time of the practice period was, how on earth would this go? You know, how would I do this? And so during this time, I had daily contact with my teacher, who was leading the practice period, Paul Haller. And then we had, you know, Dokusan on a regular basis. And I was able to experience what it might be to also be guided by a teacher through such a process, you know, and to really be challenged by the teacher in many ways. And, you know, one of the biggest challenges for me was giving Dharma talks. I don't know why it was so I do know why it was so nerve-wracking. I think it was because it was city center, because it was San Francisco Zen Center. And there was so many people in the Buddha Hall, and everybody's very serious and very quiet. And there was so much ceremony, you know, there's so much build-up to a Dharma talk there, and it's kind of broadcast, and you know, there was all sorts of ways in which it was really terrifying for me. And so the first time I gave a talk there, I was so nervous, so nervous. And I came and I sat down, and I found myself just doing everything very, very slowly, thinking to myself, I can just take up time doing everything slowly, then these 45 minutes that I have to spend, that I have to fill with talking, will be less. So I sort of took my cup of water and I drank some, and I was fiddling with my robes. And then I gave voice to this thought. You know, I said, oh, you know, here I am just trying to fill up the time. And then when I next met with my teacher, he pointed this out to me. And this sort of became a theme in a way. It became a theme. He said something along the lines of, this is all an opportunity. It's all an opportunity. In these difficult moments of our lives, you know, in these intimidating moments of our lives, do we want to just get through it? Do we want to just, you know, like grit our teeth and wait for it to finish? Or is there a way in every situation to really engage it, to really turn towards what is going on? And become part of it, you know, to harness it, no matter what it is. And so people there at the Zen Center, especially people who had Binshuso before me would say to me, you know, this experience is transformational. This is a transformational experience. And I really tried to understand what people meant when they were saying that to me. And I sort of thought, maybe everybody has a different experience of this, and maybe everybody has a different idea of what something transformational is. And one image that really stuck with me, somebody said, you know, near the beginning of the practice period, it's literally a turning experience. So because the shuso, the student, is sharing the seat of the teacher, as you know, when you're sitting in the zendo, usually you're facing the wall and the teacher faces in. Well, the shuso also faces in with the teacher. So they said to me, you know, there's a way in which you're sort of doing this literal turning. And then there's this sort of symbolic turning that's happening at the same time. And so this was helpful to me. This whole community aspect was really something that was such an eye-opener. The way that I felt that the community also was carrying me, you know, or carrying anyone who was the shuso through the training. So it wasn't just the teacher who was showing me how to do this. Everybody was, you know, literally from the first moment I arrived there, when I got there on the first day and I'd put my cases down in the apartment where I was staying. And then I came to sort of knock on the front door of City Center, literally. And Roger, who's the person who sits at the reception desk there, he opened the door, and he didn't really know me. You know, I could have been anyone, I could have been a visitor, but somehow he recognized me, and he opened the door and he said, "Hello, shuso." You know, and I was absolutely blown away. You know, I thought, how do you know? It felt a bit magic. It felt a bit magical in that way. But all through all of this, like I said, this Hosen Shiki, this ceremony, was kind of looming for me, this Dharma battle. It was something that was kind of in the distance, but coming closer every day. And it felt huge, and it sort of felt insurmountable to me. And I was preparing in all the sort of practical, small ways. Like, I had to go to Japantown to get fitted for a special kind of ceremonial white kimono. And then I had to send out invites, for example, to all the former shusos who had ever trained at Green Gulch or Tassajara or City Center, as they would all be invited to come to the ceremony. And my fellow residents at the City Center kept asking me, you know, well, how are you feeling about this? And are you ready? Do you feel ready? You know, so the more you get asked something like that, you know, the more it kind of built up. And as it came closer to the day, the teacher, or Paul, started talking to me more about impossibility. And he talked to me personally and to the Sangha in his Dharma talks. And so I also started to think, you know, I was really then beginning to think in terms of impossibility and what was ahead. What's impossible and what's inevitable. The inevitability and the relationship between what's inevitable and the sense that I have around the impossibility of something being inevitable. It's the human condition. The impossible nature of our strivings, you know, of this predicament that we find ourselves in, this inevitability of suffering, of our lives ending, of our lives ending soon. Old age, sickness, death, you know, it's all there looming in the distance, coming closer every day. And how to respond. This is such a fundamental question of our practice. How do we respond? Is there any such thing as the right response? You know, the correct thing to do. Like, you've nailed it. So what do we do? Sometimes we do Zen. And that feels like a good thing to do. It feels like a good thing to do. Like one good thing to do, maybe. Appropriate is another word that comes to my mind. Maybe this practice is an appropriate thing to do in the face of our predicament. Moving towards the impossible, you know, looking it in the eye, believing in it. Now, I said that giving the Dharma talks at City Center was really, really nerve-wracking for me. And in those moments, I sort of felt that I'd at least come into contact with an impossible predicament. You know, how to, what, talk about the Dharma? You know, what did I have to say? Goodness me. How do I get past this feeling of unworthiness or of not being ready? And even if I did have something to say, how would I say it? You know, how do I say something in a way that reaches you or reaches somebody else, given all of the complications that we're well aware of communication and words and expression? You know, and so how, in spite of all of this, not to miss that opportunity, not to miss that opportunity. And so right in those first days of that last session, it manifested for me. I started thinking about Alice in Wonderland, you know, Alice in Wonderland, not just because of, you know, her one, this character of Alice and her wonderful enthusiasm and engagement and curiosity in this kind of land of just this bonkers place that she finds herself in, but also this theme of impossibility. I don't know how familiar you are with the story, but there's this moment when she meets the queen, and the queen, I think the queen tells her that she's extraordinarily old. I can't remember how old she is. And Alice says to her, well, I don't believe you. That's impossible. And the queen said to her, I think you should try and believe the things that are impossible. And Alice sort of laughs and says, there's no use. You know, one can't believe impossible things. And the queen says to her, well, I dare say you haven't had much practice. And she says to her, when I was younger, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. I love that. I thought, What is that thing that we do for half an hour a day, every day before breakfast? So I was thinking about Alice in Wonderland, and then the Dharma talks coming from Paul, the teacher, would invoke this image also of the iron wall, you know, and how to advance. At one point he said, you know, imagine your nose is just an inch away from the iron wall, and then somebody tells you to take a step forward. And this was how he coached me, you know. And I thought, I went back to that image of the Shuso who turns around, you know. So normally we sit facing that wall, And I thought, I've turned around, the wall is behind me. But just because I don't see it, it doesn't mean it's not there. You know, it hasn't disappeared. That wall is still there. So the last day, the day of the Hosen Shiki ceremony was the last day of this Sesshin, of this silent retreat, which is the Rohatsu Sesshin. It's the one that traditionally celebrates the Buddha's awakening at the beginning of December. And there'd been a lot of ceremonies during this time. There'd been the full moon ceremony. A couple of days before that, there'd been the anniversary of the death of Suzuki Roshi. And during that particular ceremony, in the role of Shuso, I had to carry Suzuki Roshi's photograph to the altar as part of the procession. And it was this sort of really big portrait of him. His head was sort of life-sized. And I was so touched, you know, to look into his eyes that were life-sized on this picture, and to be reminded of the gentleness of his smile and the benevolence. And I felt a kind of encouragement just looking at his picture. And in one of his books, Suzuki Roshi says, in reference to the 100-foot pole, actually, there is no top of the pole. The pole continues forever, so you cannot stop there. There's no stopping at the top of the pole. And I witnessed something that was so funny in one of the last days of Sesshin. We were having a ceremony, probably at the end of the day. It was probably a short ceremony after Zazen. And the person who was doing Doshi kind of stepped forward to be Doshi for the ceremony, to be leading the ceremony like Umar was earlier. And I was very close to them. I could see them. And I noticed that they got to where they should be bowing. And they realized in that moment they didn't have their bowing mat, their zagu, with them. It wasn't on their arm. And I sort of just saw them kind of go through this moment of like, and then, you know, just sort of did standing bows instead of going down on the floor, and then went to the altar to offer the incense. And while they were at the altar offering incense with their back to the room, another priest just kind of jumped in and put their own bowing mat down for the doshi, you know, in the place where it should be. So then the doshi didn't see this, and they rounded back for the second round of bows. And they looked down, and suddenly there was a bowing mat there. And the look on their face, it was absolutely delightful. Like the look on their face of like, magic just happened. Like literally the impossible thing just happened. The thing that I needed, the one thing that I was missing, just suddenly appeared, you know. And of course it wasn't magic. Like I saw the mechanics of what had happened, but it gave rise to me. It was such an encouraging moment. You know, it gave rise to this feeling of possibility, this feeling of boundlessness. I realized in that moment how oriented I was to this koan of facing the wall. So as we were preparing for the Hosen Shiki ceremony, there was sort of a rehearsal earlier in the day, and there was a lot of activity, a lot to prepare, but nothing really for me to do. I'd learnt my lines, and I'd learnt what choreography, you know, where I needed to be when during the ceremony. So at one point I was just sitting there, and somebody came and presented me with the staff, this sort of ceremonial staff that's used during the ceremony. And the way that it's used is that when
these questions are asked, you know, when the Shuso is answering the questions, they're holding the stuff in their right hand. And every time after answering a question, you kind of bang the staff down on the floor very hard to signal that the question has been answered. And I made the mistake at some point of looking on YouTube to see if there were any recordings of this ceremony that I could watch. And I was watching at one point this young Japanese monk kind of bringing this staff down with so much conviction. You know, it really was the words Dharma combat just loomed large. You know? I thought, combat, who is this a fight? You know, who or what would I be fighting? You know, where did this young man's conviction come from? It was amazing. And so the ending's kind of anticlimactic. You know, I can tell you, I really don't remember much from the ceremony, but I do remember that I entered with body and heart. You know, that I realized that I had just enough nerves to keep me alert, but not so many that I wanted to like run away or throw up or like, you know, forget my lines or something. I think my attitude going into the Buddha hall, sort of embedded in the middle of this huge ceremonial line of bells and drums and, you know, wearing this white kimono. And I think it was ultimately just, what a privilege. You know, what a privilege, not just this moment, but all of this entire human life, you know, the chance to wear these robes, you know, to dance this dance, to meet this practice, this strange ceremony that feels so, so huge in this moment. And really, it's just a minute, microscopic little blip in the vast history of our culture, you know, and the world. So I really wanted to experience every moment. I really wanted time to slow down. And Suzuki Roshi said, when you think that here is the top, then you will have the problem of whether or not to jump off. But you cannot jump off from here. That's already a misunderstanding. It's not possible. And he also said, to forget about the top of the pole is to be where you are right now. Not to be this way or that way, not to be in the past or the future, but to be right here. So in the end, there was no wall and there was no pole. The 60 or so impossible questions came for me and I did my best. You know, there was nothing more that I could do than that. I could not be a Zen master. I couldn't be a sage. I couldn't be Paul, the teacher. I couldn't be Suzuki Roshi. I think the bit that I'd forgotten about when I was worrying about the ceremony was that the questions come from people. You know, the questions come from good, well-meaning, encouraging, supportive human beings. Some walls come down more easily than others. And then some things we can just simply put down. Other things are more deeply ingrained and it takes longer. But the more we can put down, the lighter we are. The more we can put down, the more we're primed with confidence for life to truly form us, to truly teach us and surprise us. You know, surprise us in the way that that priest was surprised when a bowing mat magically and impossibly appeared before their eyes. So the last thing is just one more quote from Suzuki Roshi. How to step through the iron wall or to jump off the pole. That's my question. How to step through the iron wall, how to jump off the 100-foot pole. Forget this moment, he said. Forget this moment and grow into the next. That is the only way. Thank you so much. I realize that was quite long. I'm sorry. but I think there's still a few minutes if you have some questions. So I already see a question on Zoom. Dave has a question. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Vanessa. Thank you so much for your talk. Your concerns about your ability to give the Dharma talks at City Center is a sort of graceful and non-egocentric attitude, but it's a little unrealistic in my experience because I think your Dharma talks are wonderful, and tonight was certainly no exception. The whole image of the 100-foot pole, I guess, kind of reminds me, maybe some of you know, about the book by Ram Dass called Be Here Now. And of course, that would contrast rather strongly with be somewhere else really soon. the idea that there's no top to the pole. And I was reminded when you talked about Alice in Wonderland and the Red Queen believing six impossible things before breakfast. There's another wonderful quote from the Red Queen about trying to be elsewhere soon. It's actually been picked up by evolutionary biologists. It's called the Red Queen Hypothesis. And the quote is, here we need to run as fast as possible just to stay in the same place. There were so many other things in your talk that resonated in my mind, but I don't want to try to monopolize the question period here, so I'll shut up now. But thank you so much for your talk. It was truly wonderful.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.